following audio is from Life Connection Church. We exist to glorify God through transformed lives by the power of the gospel. For more information about Life Connection Church, visit www.lifeconnectionkc.org.
This morning we are in Habakkuk. We're in our third week in that book. So as a church, we try throughout the year to go through different books of the Bible. The reason we do that is we want God to tell us what he's saying about himself. And we need to walk through books of the Bible to do that. But then also, God tends to use his scriptures to make us talk about things that normally we wouldn't want to talk about. Because the Bible does not hide from hard questions. And so Habakkuk is one of those books. And it deals with one of the most difficult questions that we have in our society today, and it's this question of why does a good God allow evil things to happen, period, especially to good people? And so we've been working through this letter, through this short book, the last couple of weeks. We're going to be at the beginning of chapter 2. If you're looking at a pew Bible, it's going to be on page 785. And it's a very short book, so you could easily miss it, I understand. So I'm going to give you a little bit of time to get there, because I do want you to follow along as we read this. And so just some context for where we've gotten is Habakkuk starts out with a prayer of complaint to the Lord. So he's noticing how the evil in his nation of Judah are prospering, but God doesn't seem to be doing anything to protect the righteous. And so in verses 5 through 11, God responds to Habakkuk, and his response is, I am going to punish the evil in Judah with the Babylonians, or the Chaldeans. It really depends on what translation of the Bible you have. And so then 12 through 17 of chapter 1, it's Habakkuk going, why would you use an evil nation to punish our evil nation? Like, God is responding in ways that Habakkuk has no framework for. And so he's trying to wrestle with God. And one of the things you should be encouraged by with this book is that God does not at any moment chastise Habakkuk for questioning him. Because Habakkuk is coming to the Lord. The Lord graciously responds. The Lord knows our doubts. And so he prefers that we come to him. And Habakkuk isn't the only guy in the Bible who talks to God this way. In fact, King David, a man after God's own heart, that's how God described David, wrote several of the Psalms which are like this. They are these complaints to the Lord, these questions of what are you doing, God? Like, where are you, God? Like, God wants that from us. He's not angry at us when we do that. He is gracious and kind to us in those moments. So you should take that from this little book of Habakkuk. And today we're going to look at Habakkuk chapter 2. We're going to look at how God is going to respond to Habakkuk's second complaint. We're going to read down to verse 5. So verse 1, it takes place right after Habakkuk gets done complaining to God the second time. And here's what he says. I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he'll say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. So Habakkuk's wanting this conversation to continue. Verse 2, and the Lord answered me. Write the vision, make it plain on tablets so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end, it will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come, it will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up, it's not right, upright. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol, like death, he is never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. This is the word of the Lord. So God's response to Habakkuk, and Paul mentioned this a little bit, begins with, okay, I want you to write down what I'm about to say. And then I want you to wait. It's this call for patience. That's his initial response. Just be patient. Wait for this to happen. And it's I don't know, it's interesting to me that, you know, this is the first Sunday of Advent. And so maybe you're not familiar with that term. Advent is just a time in our church calendar where we are moving and looking forward to Christmas. It's this Advent, it simply means coming. And so what we do as Christians in the church is we take this time beginning on the first Sunday of Advent, which is today, and we begin to look forward to celebrating the first coming of Jesus. If you read the Old Testament, the prophets, the people in the Old Testament, they were all waiting for that momentous occasion. And then 2,000 years ago, after 1,000 years of waiting, or longer than that even, the Messiah was born. Jesus Christ came. And so we look back and celebrate that Jesus came, that God fulfilled his promise to send the Messiah. But then in Acts chapter 1, we see Jesus after his death for our sins, after his defeat of death through his resurrection, he ascended to sit at the right hand of the Father. And when he ascended, angels told his disciples that he will come back. And one of the great hopes of the New Testament, as you read the New Testament letters especially, is that they are clinging to that promise that Jesus is coming back. Like I encourage you, as you read through the New Testament, if you're reading in the Bible reading plan, we're in a lot of the letters of the New Testament right now, like Ephesians and Galatians. Keep an eye out for how many times they talk about the future return of Jesus. It's everywhere. And so we live now in this waiting period where we have the promise of Acts chapter 1. We have the promise of the New Testament that Jesus will come back. He'll make all things good. He'll make all things right. And now we're just waiting for that promise to be fulfilled. We're in a waiting pattern. God is essentially telling us to just be patient. And so Habakkuk chapter 2, the center point of this whole book, is going to tell us how to wait patiently for the Lord. And maybe for some of you, like, it's not so much you're waiting patiently for the return of Christ. It may be that this morning you're just waiting for God to do something good in your life. Like, you look forward to the future because you're waiting for this kind of sharp turn in your life and direction and hoping that God provides a new way forward. Because as you look forward, you're having trouble seeing the path ahead. And so as you read the scriptures, or as you come in this morning, and or as you pray and ask God, wherever you're at with him, you're hoping that somewhere along the line God does something in you or does something in your life that makes your life better than it is right now. Like, you're wanting to know, where do I go from here, Lord? And so you're in this pattern where you're just waiting on him to respond, and you don't know what that's going to look like. And Habakkuk chapter 2 is going to help us to wait patiently. Because Habakkuk chapter 2, especially 2 through 5, is the center of this whole book, and it's all about waiting in faithful devotion to the Lord. Or to put it another way, as you wait, wait faithfully devoted to the Lord. And so what we're going to do this morning is we're going to kind of walk out what this looks like. And what I want to do is actually flip this text. You're going to go backwards through it. Because what I want to do first is I want to unpack what it looks like to not live devoted to the Lord. Or in verses 4's language, to live devoted to yourself. Because that's kind of, as the Bible lays it out, those are the two options for us. Maybe you don't agree with that, but that's the options the Bible gives us. You're either living devoted to the Lord or you're living devoted to yourself. So what does that mean? And because he lays that out too when he talks about the Babylonians. And the reason I want to do that is that, honestly, living a life devoted to me is much easier. It's just more natural. It's like a daily thing. Like, I don't have to fight to devote my life for my own purposes or desires. It just come up natural. And so what I want to do is, I've been like, is I just want us to help us see clearly what that looks like. Because I don't think we rarely examine or look at ourselves and go, okay, how am I living for myself? It's just so natural, we don't really see it. And so I want us to see it clearly, to kind of see where we're at in this. And then I want us to turn a corner to go, okay, now how can you live faithfully to devoted to the Lord instead? How can we move to that? So that's the two paths that we're wanting to walk. What are you doing, or what are you wanting when you're devoting your life to yourself? And then how can you live faithfully devoted to the Lord instead? Okay, we're all good? Following me there? All right, so first, what does it look like to live for yourself? So this passage, like I said, is a turning point in the letter. And so when you get down to verse 4, you have the first part of that verse says, "Behold, his soul is puffed up, it's not upright within him." Habakkuk is talking about the Chaldeans. He's talking really about the evil ones, whether they're in Judah or the Babylonians. But he's specifically about to get into who the Babylonians are. And you have to remember, this is the Lord talking through Habakkuk, okay? And then in verse 5, he describes who these people are in a little more detail. "Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he is never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples." So as we walk through these, like every line reveals a different way that we live for ourselves. So there's going to be four ways that these verses show us, one per line, that we live for ourselves, and really the way the Chaldeans are living for themselves. And so as we walk through this, what I want you to do is I just want you to evaluate yourself. As you hear me describe these things, you're, okay, is that me? Or does that fit me at all? So the first one that we see is in verse 4. This, his soul is puffed up. It's not upright within him. And the idea here is that this is someone who's very prideful, or someone who lives off the praise of others. Like his soul is puffed up, right? We might put it another way. He's got a big head. He just thinks he's better than everybody else. There's an Outkast song about that that I can't quote from the stage, about how people think their stuff don't stink. I just quoted it anyways. But this is what he's talking about. These are people who live off of the praise of others, and they're just proud. They don't think they're wrong. And so when you live on the praises of others, what happens is these are people like who focus on making sure they do a good job at everything. They're people who make sure that others know not only that you did a good job, but that you did it really, really well. Like you are someone who posts pics online to humble brag about how great you are. And what happens in the church is when we live off of the praise of others is that we end up making sure people look at us so that they think that's a good Christian. So maybe you only serve in ways that people can see, or you let people know that you're serving and helping others through like kind of subtly mentioning it in conversations. Or maybe you don't share your sin issues, but you tell others that they can share theirs with you. So you kind of prop yourself up as this counselor who doesn't need counseling. Because whenever you do see sin in you, what happens is you ignore it or you justify it. Because those who live off of the praise of others are terrified of criticism. So they hide their failure and their sins from others. Like even when you start to tell people your story, you hide the messy parts. And if someone ever finds out and calls you on your sin, you'll get defensive or you'll turn flaky. I remember a few years ago, I had to sit down with a guy, a younger guy in his early 20s, and just call him out on some issues. It was a hard conversation. It wasn't anything he was surprised by, I'll say that. And so I thought the conversation ended well. We hugged it out, all right? He left, things were good. He had some next steps he was gonna take. And then about a week later, I get this email, and it's very accusatory. And he's just kind of going through saying, you know, I don't feel heard by you. I don't feel like you are compassionate toward me. I don't feel like we're on the same page here. And my first thought was like, no, I heard you. I just didn't agree with you. It was just, and as we kind of worked through this, it's very evident, like this is someone who felt like they were in the right, and that if I just knew what they knew and thought the way they thought, then I'd come around to their point of view, that they were in the right. And I just couldn't do it. And then about a month later, he was gone. He wasn't going to get the praise he wanted to get. At least not if he's going to continue to live in sin. Like the moment, if you live on praise, the moment that you're found to struggle with your sin, you'll begin thinking of how do I escape this? How do I make this better? How do I make this up to people? How can I kind of wrap over this so it looks good? Or maybe I just need to leave and go somewhere else. Man, that's just, living on the praise of others is exhausting. Because you're working so hard to please others, and then you're working so hard to cover up what displeases you. Your soul begins to slant and get off kilter. It's no longer upright within you. The second thing that we see after this reality that people who live on praise are living for themselves, the second thing we see in living for ourselves is down in verse 5, the first stanza there. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. So a second way, maybe we don't live off the praise of others, but we live for the pleasure of life. So this idea here is that the Babylonians are so rich that they're enjoying all the luxuries of life. Wine, they're getting drunk, they're having lavish parties. Some translations might have wealth. The idea is the same. They have all the resources they need and they are just enjoying life to its fullest. And so they're overindulging in things of the world. They're partying, they're drinking, they're overeating, they're seeking out sexual pleasure and living in that kind of sexual freedom. And in the church, what happens with us is that we end up basing what we do and don't do off of what makes us happy and what we enjoy. And so when someone asks you to serve, or when you begin to think about, should I step into this role, the question you're asking is, okay, is this something I would actually like doing? And if it's not, you decide not to. Because those who live for pleasure, man, they're just terrified of being bored. And they're terrified of being inconvenienced and in pain. And what happens is, if you're living for pleasure and you're only living for what makes you feel good and what you enjoy, that changes all the time. So you become someone who's not really reliable. You flake out. Because we just never know, like, is he going to get bored? Is she going to get bored with this and just back out? But this also makes you vulnerable to things like addiction and codependency. I mean, look how Habakkuk puts it. Wine is a traitor. Wine is treacherous. It turns the tables on you. This was written 2,500 years ago, at least. But the insight is profound, right? The things that we enjoy and that we end up using for our own enjoyment end up controlling us in the end if we're not careful. So much of the alcoholism and drug addiction and eating disorders and codependent relationships and other unhealthy addictions stem from this desire to just simply, I want to live a life of pleasure and ease. And then you get trapped. That's what he says happens here. They become restless. They don't know what to do anymore. Is that you? Is that where you're at this morning? The third thing we see is in the second stanza of verse 5. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he has never enough. So this is a man who is living for his possessions. So he's devoting himself to just getting all he can get in this life. So, and he's finding his security and success in owning money or having a lot of things or having a big bank account. And his decisions or her decisions are based on whether or not it makes good financial sense and if it can bring any future security or success to my life. Even in the church, what happens is people begin to be convinced that they have to give and serve based on how it benefits them. Is this good for my life? Is this going to help me out? Is this going to help me get to where I want to get to? And if you're someone who wants to be in ministry long term, you can even begin making decisions on how to serve in the church based on whether or not it eventually will let you get in the position of power you want. Because those who live for possessions are terrified that they're never going to have enough, that they're never going to get what they need. And this can make you greedy, it makes you ungenerous. And not just in giving money, but even opening up your life to others. And the moment you feel like you're being asked to give too much, you say no, and maybe you back out. Like spiritually, he says that this leaves you hollow. You never feel satisfied. One of the stats, and I've quoted this a few different times, one of the stats that just continually blows my mind, 1 out of 4 billionaires will die by suicide. That's insane. It leaves you hollow. And you end up in this place where you're just feeling like life, like you have everything you want, but yet you're still just feel worthless. You feel like nothing measures up anymore. And then the fourth thing is power. And it's the very last stanza. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. What Habakkuk is saying here is that not even ruling the whole world is enough for them. Like you have to understand this stanza is connected to all both of the first two stanzas. It's not enough. All the power in the world still leaves you feeling empty inside. And so when you live devoted to yourself to gain control over others and to be in power, it will leave you empty. And what happens is you end up trying to use whatever gifts you have to try to lead others and to form leadership, to try to get people to follow you. You think you have the best ideas and you start getting frustrated because people don't agree with you. And when your leadership or your wisdom or your ability is challenged, you become defensive and you try to reassert yourself, either through intimidating others or manipulating. Something in you has to be in control and in charge at all times. Because those who live for power, you're terrified of being weak and helpless. And this can make you harsh, critical, and abusive. Because you need to appear strong and capable. You need others to trust you and follow you no matter what. Even though you'll say to them, you'll never follow them back. But this life will leave you anxious and stressed out. Because you can't be in control of everything. You can't control the weather. Even our meteorologists don't know what tomorrow's going to be like. I don't trust my weather app anymore at all. And when things in your life you can't control begin to cause chaos, you just dive bomb into anxiety and stress, and you take it out on everybody else because you're trying to get control of what you think you can control. This, all four of these things are really anchored in this same issue. You're living for yourself, and you believe everything else in your life should live for you too. Everything else should please you. Everything else should praise you. Everyone else should give you power and let you be in control. You should get whatever you want in life. You're living for yourself, and you view the world as this place where you can just get it and take it. And so what happens is we can end up using people for ourselves. You use them to get what you want, and we can determine our friendships even based on this. Are they someone who's going to praise me? Are they someone I enjoy being around? Are they someone who's going to help me get where I want to get in life? Are they someone who's going to follow my lead and listen to me? Like this causes cliques in the church. It causes cliques in politics. It causes cliques in the workplace. People trying to live for themselves. And what's particularly sad is when we throw God into the mix. Because what happens is God becomes this ticket to get what we really want. So I start to follow God because following God makes me look good and people praise me for it. Or I start to follow God because I believe, like the prosperity gospel, that if I follow the Lord, then I'll get everything I want materially and physically. Or if I follow God, then I won't ever suffer. I'll always feel pleasure and happy and safe. Or if I follow God, then everyone else should bow to me and my power because I'm doing it right and they're not. You end up becoming these self-righteous Pharisees. And really what ends up happening is we end up becoming these Christian atheists. And what I mean by that is we know God, but we don't really live like we know him. So you know the Bible is God revealing himself to you, but you neglect it unless it can help you and benefit you. You don't talk about him with others because he's not really on your mind unless you're trying to get something. You don't fight your sin and make hard decisions to be holy as he is holy because you care more about the judgment of your friends and your own self-judgment than you do about his. God becomes a secondary part of our lives when we're living for ourselves. And what happens is we want him to support and prop up my real life. And here's how God responds to that. He lets you do it. One of the scariest things in the world was the day I realized that one of God's most effective disciplinary measures is to let you get what you want. I mean, look at this passage. He's let the Babylonians come to power, but yet inwardly they're off kilter. They don't feel right. They're restless. And what they're seeking after is now betraying them and taking over. They're feeling dissatisfied with life, even though they have all the power and wealth in the world. And they're gathering up all these nations and peoples for themselves. And what we'll see next week is that all of that really ends up coming back on them because the people will rise up and conquer them. They've built this life for themselves that God has allowed them to build just so they can fall and be destroyed by it. So some of us, like, we have to ask the question, it's like, all right, I'm getting what I want and my life is still miserable. Could it be that God is just letting you do what you want as a punishment? To get you to this point where you're finally like, all right, I'm done. I need you, Jesus. Because here's the thing. Even in all of our sinfulness, even as we pursue praise and pride and possession and power and pleasure over and above God, God is still there desiring for us to turn and live a life devoted to him instead. And so this morning, that's the call. And this brings us to our second section of our sermon this morning is, what does that look like? What does it look like to live a life faithfully devoted to the Lord? What does it look like to actually repent, turn from pursuing these other false gods, these other things that really will leave us empty and pursue the Lord instead? And so I want you to look with me at verses 2, 3, and then we're going to look at the second half of 4. And what we're going to do is we're going to find out exactly how Habakkuk is calling these people to trust in the Lord and live a life faithfully devoted to him. And it all hinges really on the second half of verse 4. But the righteous shall live by his faith. That is one of the most important verses in the whole Bible. It's quoted 3 times in the New Testament. Twice by Paul, once in the letter of Hebrews, who we don't really know who wrote that, may have been Paul. But it's this foundational verse in the early church. Because what it's saying is essentially that those who really follow the Lord, they live by their trust in the Lord. Like, listen to how Paul quotes it in Romans chapter 1. Verse 16, he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. For the gospel is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and then also to the Greek. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. As it's written, the righteous shall live by faith. There's the quote. Now, growing up, I remember reading that and thinking, okay, maybe faith is just merely believing something, like saying, yeah, I think that's true. And I do think that's part of it. But however, what we're going to see is that faith is much more than just saying, I believe that's true. Because you can say, you know, I believe the Bible, and I can even talk to you about the Bible. But on a day-to-day basis, you're still living a life devoted to yourself. What we're going to see is that living by faith is being faithfully devoted to God in an everyday basis, no matter your circumstances. And so what does that look like? Because verse 4 is this kind of last statement from God on what they're supposed to do in verses 2 and 3. So let's look at verses 2 and 3, and we're going to see what it looks like to be faithfully devoted to God instead of being faithfully devoted to ourselves. The first thing we're going to see is that when you're faithfully devoted to God, you know God. You know God. And the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so he may run who reads it. So the idea here is that I'm going to show you a revelation, and I want you to write it down to preserve it. It's going to be this official document that no one can destroy. So it's going to happen. It's going to stand the test of time. But I also want it to be easily understood so that Gary down the street, who doesn't know a whole lot about Jesus, can come read it and understand what you're saying. So that he can know God. And he can know what God's up to and what God's going to be doing. Like, God delights in telling us about himself. He wants us to know. He has spent all of human history revealing himself to us. First, he's revealed himself to us in a very general way. Like, as you look out at creation and you look at the stars and you start to feel small and you begin to see the vastness of the universe, there's something within you that goes, someone had to make this. There's got to be something bigger than me than this. Or maybe today as you're outside, go and pick up a leaf. And I just want you to like stare at it and like try to get all the intricate designs within the leaf. How mapped out it is and how symmetrical it is. The design of like one single leaf. Or maybe go home and Google, this is really cool, like Google a snowflake under a microscope. The geometry in a snowflake is amazing. Like every angle is the same. Every snowflake has six sides. It's all the same angle. It's perfect and it's beautiful. Like we look at these things, we're like, someone had to have made this. Like this general revelation of creation and nature. I mean, that explains why we've never, ever discovered a new tribe or people group who were atheists. It explains why throughout human history, every civilization has had their own religion. Like they've looked at the world and they have intrinsically just known, all right, there has to be someone who made all this. And so they set up religious practices, set up worship practices. People come forward to say, I think I know who this is. And but then there's also a more specific and special revelation of God. God is too good and too loving to let us kind of meander around the world and not know who he is. So he, through his Spirit, revealed himself to certain people so they could write this message down so that others could read it and understand it and know him and then tell others. What Habakkuk is doing is what God has done with all the other writers of the Bible. He's saying, all right, I got a vision for you. I want you to write it down and write it in a way that others can understand and then they can go tell others. Like the whole Bible is written in this way. And what this means for us is that if we're going to be faithfully devoted to the Lord instead of being faithfully devoted to ourselves, then we need to seek to know God more than we seek to get people to know us. Does that make sense? Like, one of the things that we talk about is like, you know, if you really want to live a happy life, you have to know yourself. You know, I need to know me for a season. Well, I'm not the same person I was when I was 10 years old. Knowing myself at the age of 10 is different than knowing myself at the age of 34 and 35. But knowing God at the age of 10 is the exact same as knowing God at the age of 35, because God does not change. And so rather than living this life where I'm just kind of meandering through, always kind of in a chaos, I can know the Lord. And I can have a sure foundation. And I can look in his word, and I can look to the cross of Jesus, and I can know who God is through his own son. And I can know that through him, there's mercy, there's forgiveness, there's grace for me. I can be faithfully devoted to the Lord because I'm seeking to know God. And so what this means is that this requires of us that we read his words. This requires of us that we hear his words taught by those who have studied and know the Bible better than we do. It requires that we discuss his words with others. It requires that we take the Bible seriously and the church seriously. Because these are the ways that God has chosen to reveal himself. So so if I could throw out a couple of suggestions for us over the next few weeks, here are two things I think we could do to help know God, be faithfully devoted to God by knowing him. Is one, if you're not already in a Bible reading plan, choose one of the four Gospels to read through between now and Christmas. Just read a chapter a day. The goal is, once again, you're wanting to know who Jesus is, because we're going to be celebrating his birth. So why not focus in on the person of Jesus? And then secondly, we have four more Sundays between now and the end of the year. What if you just made a personal commitment to be here every week? I know holidays come up. We're not going to meet the very last Sunday of this month because of that. But if between now and then you say, I'm going to be here. I'm going to be with God's people to worship. I'm going to be with God's people to prepare my own heart for Christmas. You're saying no and already making a commitment to deny your own self in order to faithfully devote yourself to the Lord. Secondly, and I'm going to have to really push through because I'm going a little longer than I thought I would. Secondly, not only do they know God, but they tell others what they know. So look at this. So he may run who reads it, for the vision still awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. Have you ever played, this reminds me of that game Telephone. Have you ever played that when you were a kid? And so you sit in a circle, and then one person starts it off, and they whisper in someone's ear like a short sentence. And then that person whispers in the next person's ear, and it just goes around until it gets back to the person who started it. And by the end, what happens is, like, you start out with the statement like, hey, I got new shoes. And by the time it gets back to you, it's Michael Scott has the blues or something like that. It's really, like, twisted. Somewhere along the line, you're like, where did you get that? That didn't even make sense to me. But that's the idea we see here. The person who reads it may run. That's how the English Standard Version translates it. That's a more literal translation, but maybe a better translation is in the NIV or in the New Living Translation. It's the idea that the person who reads it may run to tell others. This is a warning from God. We need to let everybody know. Which is why the message has to be really clear. Because unlike telephone, it matters if you get the message wrong. And this missional command is still true of us today. Paul, once again in Romans chapter 10, says, like, how will they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in whom they've never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are people to preach unless they're sent? And the idea is that we as Christians, we're to go, we're to preach or tell the good news to others so they can hear it and believe it and then call on God to save them. And that's what Jesus called us to do in Matthew 28 when he tells his disciples, go and make disciples. The verb there is make disciples. Go is a description of how we do that. This missional reality even determines in the church how we raise up other leaders. In 2 Timothy, Paul tells his protege right before Paul is about to die that Timothy should take what he's heard from him and entrust it to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. That's a qualification of the men that Timothy is supposed to raise up, men who are going to go and tell others. We're like funnels. taking in what we know about God and then dripping it out onto others. Investing in them. Like the person faithfully devoted to God is more concerned with people praising God than their own praise. They're more concerned with living under the rule of God than being in charge. They know God, they want others to know him, and they will risk comfort and praise and ease to tell others. That's why we got that resource table back there. Because we want you to take the message of Jesus to others. So everything back there on that table is free, outside of anything that's marked. The shirts are $10. But every resource on that table is free to you. If you don't have a Bible, take the Bible home from the pew rack. We want you to have the resources to be able to go and tell others. That's why we want to raise up leaders within our own congregation so we can know this is someone who's going to go tell others. This is why we were raising money through Hope for the City on December 15th so that we have the resources to train leaders within our church to do that. It's why all of next year we're going to focus really narrowly on the 64123 zip code as our missional focus, going block to block in prayer walking and trying to meet as many people as we can, because we want to have a plan to tell others what we know about God. Like, what we know about God is that he has graciously saved us from our sins and that he is here with us. Like, what we know is the message of Advent. And so being faithfully devoted to God, we want to make that the message of our lives, not look how great I am. But then lastly, these people who are faithfully devoted to God also have a patient confidence in the Lord. They just trust that God will do what he says he'll do. Great works of faith are not always found in these public displays of defiance to evil. The great work of faith, and this is probably one of the more important things I want to say this morning. Great works of faith aren't always found in just going to hard places to preach the good news where the gospel's never been heard. Those things are great acts of faith. But more often than not, great acts of faith are found in the day-to-day lives of Christians who are just persevering through life. They're treating God as if he's real. And they're living their day-to-day life as if God will actually do what he says he'll do for them. So some of the best examples of this are those who've been in the faith for like 20, 30, 40 years, and their daily basis, they go to their 9-to-5 job, they come to church every week, they just keep trucking. And I hope that you know people like that. Because we need people like that in our faith. Like, I remember when we first had Everett, we were in that social group where a lot of our other friends were having their first kid too. And so we did this really kind of stupid thing where we would try to give each other advice on how to raise a kid that none of us, like all of us just got. So what we'd do is we'd go online, we'd read blogs, read Facebook posts, and then we'd become 100% convinced this is the way I'm going to keep my kid from becoming a prisoner in the prison system. This is how I'm going to keep my kid from going insane and being a psychopath. And we would try to convince everybody else of that. And so every little thing with your first kid, like, we're freaking out. Are we messing him up for life? And I thank God for Thursday morning coffee time with Tim Driller. He has two sons, fully raised, and I would begin to freak out about Everett, my oldest, and he would just say, "Ah, he'll be fine." I needed someone in my life who'd gone before me to calm me down and to remind me of what was true. He's not dead. He's getting healthy. This will be okay. Like, we need that in our faith. We all have this great ambition to do great things for the Lord. And by great things, a lot of times we mean, like, I want to go overseas. I want to have, like, this little house church in my church, in my home. I want to just see people come to faith in droves. And I want to plant churches. Like, those are all great ambitions to have. But if those are the only things you can think of as being great things for the Lord, then what are you going to do with the 99% of the rest of your life? What are you going to do with the ordinary things where you have to get up in the morning and all of a sudden your kid is throwing up and you're staying home from work that day? What we need is someone in the faith to come along and say, aside us and say, all that's okay. All that's still good. And if I'm honest, Tim Driller's also filled that role for me. I say with no hint of exaggeration, if it were not for those weekly morning coffees with Tim, where I could just hash things out, I don't know if we'd be here. He's been with the Lord long enough to know, Chris, you're acting crazy, you're forgetting who Jesus is. We need men and women like that in our life to come around us and remind us of what it looks like to be faithfully devoted to God. So that in those moments of waiting, we're not tempted to go, okay, I'm just gonna do me. Now I'm just gonna live off the praises of others. I'm just gonna live off my possessions and my pleasure. No, in those moments of boredom, those are actually some of the greatest moments of faith. Things like when my grandma continued to faithfully love and serve my grandpa even after he had his fourth stroke and couldn't do anything for himself. Or how some of you have taken in kids from the foster system because their mom and dads are just struggling and need some help. Or how some of you open up your dinner table to those who don't feel comfortable coming in here on a Sunday morning. Or the ordinary faithfulness of just committing to a local church and not leaving, even when there's a bigger church down the road with a bigger budget setting up shop. Or every week, how you come in to set up, serve guests, teach our kids, lead worship, even when there might be a really long gap between people saying thank you for it. How you read Bible stories to your kids every night, and you just don't quit, even though your kids don't seem to pay attention. It's not going through, just like that's preaching to me right now. Or the great faithfulness of just constantly praying for family and friends and not giving up until you see God do something. Or getting up morning after morning after morning to read the Bible, even when you're in a spiritual dry spell. These are great things to the Lord because you are faithfully devoting yourself to the promises of God to use those ordinary habits in every part of your day to honor Him. And so this morning, some of us, we just need to come and humble ourselves before the Lord and admit, I've been a little puffed up. I've been a little prideful and arrogant. I've been finding my hope in pleasures and possessions and in power, and I have not been faithfully devoted to you. You need to open up to God and confess that. And you need to turn to them this morning. Whether you are a follower of Jesus for years or this is your first time here, that is a next step for all of us. And then we need to get up and worship. Because all of those sins of pride have been taken from us by Jesus. And all the help we need to be faithfully devoted to the Lord is given to us by Jesus through His Spirit. So let's be a church that's faithfully devoted to the Lord, and let's just keep plugging along day after day. Let's pray. Father, I'm grateful for your word. Lord, I'm grateful for what you've done and how you saved us. Lord, I'm grateful that it is by faith that we can live, Lord, that you don't look at us and demand perfection, but you demand and ask that we trust you, that we live a life faithfully devoted to you. And Father God, I pray that you would, in this moment, Father, just continue to work in our hearts, that we would just examine ourselves, confess our need, and Lord, that we would faithfully devote ourselves to you, the God who loves us and cares for us. In Christ's name, amen.